She doesn't. She cares about a person who cares about hockey. And because she dreams of a summer, just one, when her husband can look his town in the eye without lowering his gaze. Soon's chest rises and falls below slouched shoulders as he starts to walk toward the entrance to the rink. For the first time in his life, he feels his age, his body moving with slithery movements as if someone's tried to put a tracksuit on a bag of jellyfish. But when he opens the door, a great calm still settles over him the way it does every day. This is the only place in the world that he really understands. So he tries to remember what it's given him rather than what they're planning to take away from him. A lifetime in the service of the sport, which is more than most people can say. He's been blessed with a few moments of magic and has seen two immortal talents born. The noisy buggers in the big cities will never be able to understand that, what it feels like to nurture a truly talented player on a really small hockey team. Like seeing a cherry tree in bloom in a frozen garden. You can wait years, a whole lifetime, maybe several, and it would still be a miracle if you experienced it just once. Twice ought to have been impossible. Anywhere but here. The first time was Peter Anderson. That's more than 40 years ago now. Soon, who had only just been appointed A-team coach at the time, caught sight of him during skating classes. A scrawny little kid with hand-me-down gloves, a drunk for a father, and bruises everyone saw but nobody asked about. Hockey noticed him when no one else did, changed his life with colossal force. One day, that little kid grew up and raised a bankruptcy-threatened club that everyone had written off to the second best in the country. And then he raised himself up to the NHL, the impossible path from the forest to the stars, before fate snatched it all away from him. It was Soon who called Peter in Canada after the funeral and told him that Beartown needed a general manager, that there was still a club and a town here that needed rescuing, and Peter needed something to rescue. That was how the Anderson family came to move home. The second time was about 10 years ago. Soon and Peter broke away from the search party in the forest because Soon realized they were looking for a hockey player, while everyone else thought they were looking for an ordinary boy. They found Kevin out on the lake at dawn, his cheeks touched by frostbite, the look of the bear in his eyes. It was Peter who carried the 7-year-old back home. Soon walked alongside in silence, inhaling deeply through his nostrils. In the depths of winter, the town smelled of cherry blossom again. When a taciturn 22-year-old A-team player that year gave up the fight against recurring injuries and a lack of talent, it was Soon who stopped him in the parking lot. He was the one who saw the makings of a brilliant coach when everyone else saw a failed player. The 22-year-old was called David, and he stood awkwardly in front of Soon and whispered, "I'm no good as a coach." But Soon gave him a whistle and said, "Anyone who thinks they're a good coach never is." David's first team was a gang of 7-year-olds, and one of the players was Kevin. David told them to win, and they won, and didn't stop. Kevin is 17 now. David is coach of the junior team, and next season they'll both be on the A team. Together with Peter, they make up the holy trinity of the future. Hands on the ice, heart on the bench, brain in the office. And now Soon's discoveries will be his downfall. Peter is going to fire him, David will take his job, and Kevin will prove to everyone that it was the right decision. An old man saw the future, and now it's overtaken him. He opens the door to the rink, lets its sounds tumble toward him. Why does he care about hockey? Because his life will be silent without it. Why? No one's ever asked Amat that. Hockey hurts. It demands inhuman sacrifices, physically and mentally and emotionally. It breaks feet and tears ligaments and forces him to get out of bed before dawn. It eats all his time, swallows all his energy. So why? Because when he was little, he once heard that there are no former hockey players. And he knows exactly what that means. That was back in skating class, when Amit was 5 years old, The A-team coach came down onto the ice to talk to the children. Soon was a fat old man even then, but he looked Amit right in the eye when he said, "Some of you were born with talent, some weren't. Some of you are lucky and got everything for free. Some of you got nothing. But remember, when you're out on the ice, you're all equals. And there's one thing you need to know. Desire always beats luck." It's easy for a child to fall in love with something if they're told that they can be best at it, as long as they want it enough. And no one wanted it more than Amit. Hockey became a way into society for him and his mother. He's planning to turn it into more than that. He's planning to make it the way out as well. Every part of his body hurts. Every cell is pleading with him to lie down and rest. But he swings around, blinks the sweat away, clutches his stick more tightly, and drives his skates across the ice. As fast as he can, as hard as he can. Again, again, again. Everything reaches an age when it no longer surprises us. That applies even to hockey. Most days you'd think there aren't any original ideas left, that everything has already been thought, said, and written by a whole range of coaches, each one more confident than the last. The other sort of day is more rare. The unusual occasions when the ice still manages to reveal things that are beyond description. Things that surprise. The caretaker is heading toward the stands to put some new screws in an old railing. He sees Soon open the main door and is surprised, because Soon is never here this early. "You're up bright and early today," the caretaker chuckles. "You have to work hardest just before the final whistle," Soon smiles wearily. The caretaker nods sadly. As already noted, Soon's dismissal is the worst-kept secret in town. The old man is on his way up through the stands, heading for his office, when he stops. The caretaker raises an eyebrow. Soon nods toward the boy out on the ice. He squints. His eyes aren't what they were. "Who's that?" "Amit, one of the 15-year-olds on the boys' team." "What's he doing here so early in the morning?" "He's here every morning." The boy has put his gloves, hat, and jacket down as markers between the lines. He skates as fast as he can until he reaches them, then changes direction without appearing to lose any speed at all. Then stops abruptly and explodes. The puck never leaves his stick. Back and forth, 5 times, 10 times, without any loss of intensity. Then the shots, the puck in exactly the same place in the net at the end of each approach. Again. Again. "Every morning, is he being punished by someone for something then?" Soon mutters. The caretaker chuckles. "He just loves hockey. You remember how that feels, old man." Soon doesn't answer, grunts as he looks at his watch, and heads up through the stands. He's almost reached the top row when he stops again. He tries to take another step, but his heart won't let him. He's seen Amit in skating class. He sees all these boys there. But it wasn't as obvious then. Hockey is a sport that rewards repetition. The same exercises, the same movements, until a player's responses become instinctive, branded into his marrow. The puck doesn't just glide, it bounces as well, so acceleration is more important than maximum speed, hand-eye coordination more important than strength. The ice judges you by your ability to change direction and thought quicker than anyone else. That's what separates the best players from the rest. There are vanishingly few of them, those days when the game can still surprise us. When it does happen, it comes without warning. We just have to trust that we'll recognize it. So when the echo of the skates cutting into the ice bounds up the banks of seating, Soon stops and pauses for a moment before casting one final glance over his shoulder again. He sees the 15-year-old turn, holding his stick lightly in his hand, then set off again at blistering speed. And Soon will remember this as one of the true blessings in his life. Seeing the impossible happen in Beartown for a third time. The caretaker looks up from the screws in the railing and sees the old coach sink into one of the seats on the top row. At first, he seems to be seriously ill. Then the caretaker realizes that it's because he's never seen the old man laugh before. Soon is breathing through his nose with tears in his eyes, and the whole rink smells of cherry blossom. Why does anyone care about hockey? Because it tells stories. Chapter 6. Amit leaves the rink with every scrap of fabric on his body transparent with sweat. From the top row of the stands, Soon watches him go. The boy is lucky. He didn't notice the A-team coach sitting there. If he had, his nerves would have sent him diving headfirst onto the ice. Soon remains seated after Amit's gone. He's been old for a long time, but is really feeling it today. There are two things that are particularly good at reminding us how old we are. Children and sports. In hockey, you're an experienced player at 25, a veteran at 30, and pensioned off at 35. Soon is twice that. And with age, he has become shorter and broader. He's got more face to wash and less hair to comb, and finds himself getting annoyed by narrow chairs and poor quality zippers. But when the door closes behind Amit, the old man can still smell cherry blossom in his nostrils. 15 years old. Bloody hell, what a future. Soon is ashamed of the fact that he's only just noticed him. The boy has clearly developed in an explosive fashion recently, while everyone else has had their eyes on the junior team, but a few years ago, Soon would never have missed a talent like that. He can't blame it all on his old eyes. He's got an old heart as well. He knows he won't be here long enough to get the chance to coach the boy, but he hopes no one ruins his talent by cutting him down, or by letting him grow too quickly. But he knows there's no point wishing for anything like that, because when all the others realize how good this boy is, they'll want to start squeezing results out of him immediately. The club needs that. The town demands that. Soon has had this argument with the board time and time again over the years, and he always loses. It would take days to recount the long version of why Soon is being fired from Beartown Ice Hockey Club. But the short version is only two words long. Kevin Erdahl. The sponsors, the board, and the club's president have all demanded that Soon let the 17-year-old wunderkind play in the A-team, and Soon has refused. In his world, it takes more than hormones to turn boys into men. Senior hockey requires maturity just as much as it does talent, and he's seen more players crushed by opportunities proffered too early than too late. But no one's listening anymore. The people of Beartown are proud of being bad losers. Soon knows that he himself bears much of the blame for that. He's the one who imprinted the words, "Club comes first," into every player and coach since his first day here. The good of the club must always come first, never anyone's ego. They're using that against him now. He could have saved his job by letting Kevin play in the A-team, and he wishes he was certain he's done the right thing. But he genuinely doesn't know any longer. Maybe the board and the sponsors are right. Maybe he's just a stubborn old goat who's lost his grip. David is at home, lying on his kitchen floor. He's 32 years old, and his red hair is so unruly it looks like it's trying to escape from his head. He got teased about it when he was little. The other kids pretended to burn themselves on him in class. That was where he learned to fight. He didn't have any friends, which is why he was able to devote all his time to hockey. He never bothered to acquire any other interests, which is how he's managed to become the best. Sweat is dripping on the floor as he frantically performs push-ups under the kitchen table. His computer is on top of it. He's been watching videos of old matches and training sessions all night. Being junior team coach for Beartown Ice Hockey makes him a simple man to understand and an impossible man to live with. When his girlfriend gets annoyed with him, she usually tells him he's the sort of man who could take offense in an empty room. That could be true. His face looks like he's walking into a headwind. He's always been told that he's too serious. That's why hockey suits him so well. No one on a hockey team thinks it's possible to take hockey too seriously. The match tomorrow is the most important in David's life, as well as the juniors. A more philosophically inclined coach might tell them that those could be their last 60 minutes on the ice as children, because most of them will be turning 18 this year. Then they'll be grown men and seniors. But David isn't philosophical, so he'll just say his usual single word to them. Win. He doesn't have the best players in the country, far from it. But they're the most disciplined, and have received the best tactical training. They've been playing together all their lives. And they've got Kevin. They rarely play beautifully. David believes in detailed strategy and a solid defense, but above all, he believes in results. Even when the board and parents keep going on about letting the players lose and trying to play more enjoyable hockey, David doesn't even know what enjoyable hockey is. He only knows one sort of hockey that isn't enjoyable, the one where the opposing team scores more points. He's never let anyone else influence him. He's never given a place on the team to the son of a marketing manager at one of the big sponsors like he's been told to. He's uncompromising. He knows that's not going to make him any friends, but he doesn't care. Do you want to be liked? It's easy. Just get yourself to the top of the podium. So David does whatever it takes to get up there. That's why he doesn't see his team the same way everyone else does. Because even if Kevin is the best player, he isn't always the most important. The computer on the kitchen table is showing a game from earlier in the season when an opposing player sets off after Kevin with the obvious intention of tackling him from behind, but the next moment is himself lying flat on the ice. Another Beartown player, number 16, is standing over him, already missing his gloves and helmet. A torrent of punches rains down on the opposing player. Kevin might be the star, but Benjamin Ovich is the heart of the team. Because Benji is like David. He's prepared to do whatever it takes. So ever since he was small, the coach has drummed one single idea into him. Don't pay any attention to what people say, Benji. They'll like us well enough when we start winning. He's 17 years old, and his mom wakes him early by saying his full name. She's the only person who uses it. Benjamin. Everyone else calls him Benji. He stays in bed, in the smallest room in the last row house at the far end of Beartown, just before the start of the Hollows, until she comes in for the third or fourth time. When words from her homeland creep into her exhortations, he gets up, because that's when it gets serious. His mom and Benji's three older sisters only slip into the old language when they want to express great anger or eternal love. And this country simply doesn't have sufficiently flexible grammar to express which good-for-nothing part of the laziest, useless donkey Benji might be, or how they love him as deeply as 10,000 wells full of gold. His mom can get both elements into the same sentence. It's a remarkable language in that sense. She watches him as he cycles off. She hates having to force him out of bed before the sun has risen. But she knows that if she goes to work without driving her son out of the house, he wouldn't leave it at all. She's a single mother with three daughters, but it's this 17-year-old boy who worries her more than anything. A boy who cares too little about the future and frets too much about the past. Nothing could depress a mother more. Her little Benjamin, the fighter with whom it's far too easy for the girls of Beartown to fall in love. The boy with the most handsome face, the saddest eyes and the wildest heart they've ever seen. His mom knows, because she married a man who looked just the same. And nothing but trouble lies ahead for men like that. David is making coffee in his kitchen. He always brews an extra pot each morning and fills the thermos. The coffee at the rink is so bad you ought to be able to charge someone for assault just for offering it to you. His computer is playing a match from last year in which Kevin is being pursued by a furious defender until Benji appears at full speed out of nowhere and hits the defender on the back of his neck with his stick, sending him flying headfirst into the opposing team's bench. Half the team storms onto the ice to get revenge on Benji, who is standing there waiting for them without his helmet, fists clenched. It takes the referees 10 minutes to get the fight under control. In the meantime, Kevin has gone to sit down quietly on his own bench, unharmed and untroubled. Some people try to make excuses for Benji's temperament by blaming his tough childhood, the fact that his dad died when he was young. David never does that. He loves Benji's temperament. Other people call him a problem child, but all the characteristics that make him a problem off the ice are what make him so special on it. If you send him into a brawl, it doesn't matter if serpents, trolls, and all the monsters of hell are in the way. Benji always comes out with the puck. If anyone gets anywhere near Kevin, he'll fight through concrete to place himself in the way, and that sort of thing can't be taught. Everyone knows how good Kevin is. Every youth team coach on each of the top clubs in the country has tried to recruit him. And that also means that every team they play contains at least one psycho who wants to hurt him. So David doesn't accept it when people say that Benji ends up fighting in every other match. He's not fighting. He's protecting the most important investment the town has ever seen. But David has stopped using that particular word in front of his girlfriend, investment, because, as she put it, is that really any way to talk about a 17-year-old? David has learned not to try to explain it. Either you understand that aspect of hockey, or you don't. On the road that links the row houses to the rest of the town, Benji stops his bicycle at the point where his mother can no longer see him and lights a joint. He lets the smoke fill him, feels the sweet calmness rise and fall. His long, thick hair stiffens in the wind, but the cold has never bothered him. He cycles everywhere, no matter what time of year it is. At practice, David often commends him on his calf muscles and sense of balance in front of the other players. Benji never replies because he suspects that saying, "That's what you get if you ride a bike through deep snow every day when you're high as a kite," isn't the answer the coach wants to hear. On his way to his best friend's house, he passes through the whole of Beartown, the factory that's still the largest employer in the town, but which has effectivized its personnel 3 years in a row now, a fancy way of saying people have been laid off. The big supermarket that has closed down its smaller competitors. A street full of stores in varying states of disrepair, and an industrial area that is just getting quieter and quieter. The sports store, which has one section for hunting and fishing, and another for hockey, but very little else worth mentioning. A little farther out is the pub, the Bearskin, frequented by the sort of men who make it such an excellent destination for any curious tourist eager to find out what it's like to get beaten up by the locals. Toward the forest, off to the west, is a garage, and farther in among the trees, the kennels that Benji's eldest sister runs. She raises two types of dogs, hunting dogs and guard dogs. No one around here wants dogs for pets anymore. There's not much to love about this place, apart from hockey. But on the other hand, Benji hasn't loved very much else in his life. He inhales the smoke. The other guys keep warning him he'll get kicked off the team if David finds out he smokes weed, but Benji just laughs, secure in the knowledge that would never happen. Not because Benji is too good to be thrown off the team, definitely not, but because Kevin is too good. Kevin is the jewel, Benji the insurance policy. Soon looks up at the roof of the rink one last time, at the flags and jerseys hanging there, memories of men soon no one will be old enough to remember. Alongside them hangs a shabby banner bearing what used to be the club's motto, "Culture, Values, Community." Soon helped hang it there, but he's no longer sure what it means. Sometimes he's not sure if he knew back then either. Culture is an odd word to use about hockey. Everyone says it, but no one can explain what it means. All organizations like to boast that they're building a culture, but when it comes down to it, everyone really only cares about one sort. The culture of winning. Soon is well aware that the same thing applies the world over, but perhaps it's more noticeable in a small community. We love winners, even though they're very rarely particularly likable people. They're almost always obsessive and selfish and inconsiderate. That doesn't matter. We forgive them. We like them while they're winning. The old man stands up and makes his way toward his office, with his back creaking and heart hardened. The door closes behind him. His personal belongings are already packed in a small box that's tucked under the desk. He won't make a scene when he gets fired, won't speak to the press. He's just going to disappear. That's how he was brought up, and that's how he's brought others up. The team comes first. No one really knows how the pair of them became best friends, but everyone has long since given up any attempt to separate them. Benji rings the doorbell of the house that's more than half the size of the entire block where he lives. Kevin's mom opens the door with her ever-friendly yet constantly stressed smile, clutching her phone to her ear, while behind her Kevin's dad walks past, talking loudly into his. The walls of the front hall are decorated with family photos, but those framed pictures are the only place Benji has ever seen all three members of the Erdahl family side by side. In real life, one of them always seems to be in the kitchen, the other in the study, and Kevin in the garden. Bang, 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 bang. A door closing, an apology directed at a phone. Yes, sorry, it's my son. The hockey player, yes, that's right. No one raises their voice in this house, and no one ever lowers it, either. All communication has had its emotions amputated. Kevin is simultaneously the most and least spoiled kid Benji has ever met. The fridge is full of prepared meals made in exact accordance with the nutrition plan provided by the team, delivered every 3 days by a catering company. The kitchen in the Erdahl family's house costs 3 times more than the whole of Benji's mom's row house, but no one ever prepares a meal in it. Kevin's room has everything a 17-year-old could dream of, including the fact that no adult except the cleaner has set foot inside it since he was 3. No one in Beartown has ever spent more on their son's sports career. No one has given more to the team in sponsorship than his dad's company. Yet Benji can count the number of times he's seen Kevin's parents in the crowd of spectators on the fingers of one hand and still have 2 fingers left. Benji asked his friend about it once. Kevin replied, "My parents aren't interested in hockey." When Benji asked what they were interested in, Kevin replied, "Success." They were 10 years old at the time. When Kevin is top of the class in history tests, which he almost always is, and goes home and says he got 49 out of 50 questions right, his dad merely asks in an expressionless voice, "What did you get wrong?" Perfection isn't a goal in the Erdahl family. It's the norm. Their home is white and precise, an advertisement for right angles. When he's sure no one's looking, Benji silently nudges the shoe rack 1 inch out of line and touches a couple of the photos on the wall so that they're hanging ever so slightly crooked. And as he walks across the rug in the living room, he lets his big toe fleetingly mess up some of the fringe. When he reaches the terrace door, he sees Kevin's mom's reflection in the glass. She's going around mechanically, putting everything back to how it was without missing a beat of her telephone conversation. Benji goes out into the garden, grabs a chair, and goes to sit near Kevin, then closes his eyes and listens to the banging. Kevin pauses, his collar black with sweat. "Are you nervous?" he asks. Benji doesn't open his eyes. "Do you remember the first time you came out into the forest with me, Kev? You'd never been hunting before and held your rifle like you were scared it was going to bite you." Kevin sighs so deeply that half of the air probably escapes from another bodily opening. "Aren't you ever going to take anything in life seriously?" Benji's broad grin reveals an almost imperceptible difference in the color of his teeth. "If you send him into a skirmish, he'll come out with the puck, even at the cost of one of his own teeth or someone else's." "You almost managed to shoot me in the balls. I take that very seriously." "So you're really not nervous about the game?" "Kev, you and a gun anywhere close to my testicles make me nervous. Hockey doesn't make me nervous." They're interrupted by Kevin's parents calling goodbye. His dad, in the same tone he would use to say goodbye to a waiter in a restaurant. His mom, with a cautious little sweetheart at the end. As if she really is trying, but can't quite manage to make it sound like anything more than a line she's learned for a play. The front door closes, 2 cars start up out in the drive. Benji fishes another joint from the inside pocket of his jacket and lights up. "Are you nervous, Kev?"
"No. No, no."
Benji laughs. His friend has never been able to lie to him.
"Really?"
"Okay, what the fuck, Benji? I'm shitting myself here. Is that what you want to hear?" Benji looks like he's fallen asleep.
"How much have you smoked already today?" Kevin chuckles.
"Nowhere near enough," Benji mumbles, and curls up on the chair as if he were thinking of hibernating for winter.
"You know you've got to be at school in an hour."
"All the more reason.
If David finds out, you'll get kicked off the team."
"No, I won't." Leaning on his stick, Kevin says nothing and just looks at him. Of all the things in the world you can be envious of your best friend for, this is what Kevin would most like to have. The ability that Benji has always had to not give a shit about anything, and to get away with it. Kevin shakes his head and laughs in resignation.
"No, you won't."
Benji falls asleep. Kevin turns toward the goal, and his eyes turn black. Bang,
again, again, again. At home in his kitchen, David does his last push-ups. Then he showers, gets dressed, packs his case, and grabs his car keys to drive to the rink and start work. But the very last thing the 32-year-old coach does before leaving the house is put his coffee down on the little table beside the door and run into the bathroom. There he locks the door and turns the taps on in both sink and bathtub so that his girlfriend won't hear him throwing up. Chapter 7. It's only a game. Everyone who plays it gets told that from time to time. A lot of people try to tell themselves that it's true, but it's complete nonsense. No one in this town would have been the same if that game hadn't existed. Kevin always goes to the bathroom just before he and Benji go to school. He doesn't like using the bathrooms at school, not because they're disgusting, but because they make him feel stressed. They make him feel anxious in a way he's never quite been able to identify. He can only relax enough at home, surrounded by overpriced tiles and a sink that's as exclusive as it is impractical, carefully selected by an interior designer who invoiced for many more hours than the workmen. This house is the only place in the world he has ever learned to be alone. Everywhere else, in the rink, or at school, or even on the way to and from them, he is part of a group, always in the middle, with the team gravitating toward him in order of their ability on the ice, the best players closest to him. At home, Kevin learned to be alone at such a young age that it became natural, but now he can't bear being alone anywhere else. Benji is waiting outside the house, as always. A boy with less control of his impulses than Kevin would have hugged him. Instead, he just nods and mutters, "Let's go." Maya walks away from her dad's car so fast that Anna has to jog to keep up with her. Anna holds out a plastic cup. "Do you want some? I'm on the green smoothie diet now." Maya slows down and shakes her head. "Why do you keep doing those diets? Why do you hate your taste buds so much? What have they ever done to you?" "Shut up. This is really good. Try it." Warily, Maya puts her lips to the edge of the cup. She takes half a sip before spitting it out. "It's got lumps!" Anna nods happily. "Peanut butter." Disgusted, Maya picks at her tongue with her fingers as if it were covered with invisible hairs. "You need help, Anna. Serious help." Beartown used to have more schools because there used to be more children. Now there are just two buildings left. One for primary and middle school pupils, and one for high school. They all have lunch in the same cafeteria. The town is no bigger than that anymore. Amit runs to catch up with Letha and Zacharias in the parking lot. The three boys have been in the same class all the way through school and have been best friends since preschool. Not because they are particularly similar, but because they shared the fact that they weren't like everyone else. In places like Beartown, the most popular children become leaders at a young age. Teams are invisibly chosen as early as the playground. Amit, Letha, and Zacharias were the sort of children who got passed over. They've stuck together ever since. Letha is less talkative than a tree, Zacharias louder than a radio, and Amit just appreciates the company. They make a good team. "Such a clean headshot. He tried to chicken out and hide. What the hell, are you even listening, Amit?" Zacharias, wearing the same black jeans and black hoodie and black cap that he seems to have been wearing since they were 10 years old, interrupts his speech about his evidently extremely impressive performance against a heavily armed sniper in a virtual universe last night, and shoves Amit in the shoulder. "What? Did you even hear what I was saying?" Amit yawns. Yeah, headshot. Amazing. I'm just hungry." "Did you go training this morning?" Zacharias asks. "Yeah." "You're not right in the head getting up that early." Amit grins. "So when did you get to bed last night?" Zacharias shrugs and massages his thumbs. 4 o'clock? Okay, 5, maybe." Amit nods. "You spend as much time gaming as I do training, Zach. We'll see who turns professional first." Zacharias is about to answer when his head is knocked forward hard by the slap of an open palm. Zacharias, Amit, and Letha know it's Bobo before they even turn around. Zacharias' cap lands on the ground to the sound of laughter from the juniors who have suddenly surrounded them. Zacharias, Amma, and Leifa are 15 years old. The juniors are only 2 years older, but they're so much more developed physically that there could easily have been 10 years between them. Bobo is the biggest of them, as wide as a barn door, and ugly enough to make rats move house. He shoves Zacharias hard with his shoulder as he walks past, and Zacharias stumbles and falls to his knees. Bobo laughs with feigned surprise, and the juniors surrounding him join in. "Nice beard, Zach. You look more like your mother every day," Bobo smirks. And before the junior's laughter dies away, he goes on. "Have you got any hair on your balls yet? Or do you still cry in the shower when you realize it's just fluff from your underpants?" Fuck, Zach. Seriously, though, there's something I've been wondering. The first time you, Amma, and Leifa slept together, how did you work out which of you guys was going to lose his virginity first? The juniors head off toward the school. They'll have forgotten the exchange within 30 seconds, but it takes a long while for their laughter to die away for the boys behind them. Amit sees the silent hatred in Zacharias' eyes as he helps him up. It grows stronger each morning. Amit worries that one day it's going to explode. All kinds of things, big and small, can make you love being part of a team. When Kevin was at primary school, he went with his dad to the Christmas market in Head. His dad had a meeting, so Kevin went around on his own, looking at the displays and stalls. He got lost and was 5 minutes late getting back to the car, and his dad had already left. Kevin had to walk all the way back to Beartown on his own, in the dark. The snowdrifts by the sides of the road reached his thighs, and it took him half the night to get home. He staggered, wet and exhausted, into the silent house. His parents were already asleep. His dad wanted to teach him the importance of being punctual. 6 months later, the hockey team was playing in a tournament in another town. The rink was the biggest the boys had seen, and on the way to the bus, Kevin got lost. The older brothers of three of the players in a team Kevin had humiliated a couple of hours earlier found him, dragged him into a washroom, and beat him up. Kevin will never forget the look of astonishment on their faces when another primary school kid showed up and took on all three of them in a storm of kicks and punches. Benji and Kevin were both covered with blood and bruises when they arrived at the bus more than 45 minutes late. David was standing there waiting. He had told the rest of the team to leave without him. He'd catch the train with Benji and Kevin when they showed up. But every player on the team had refused to get on the bus. They weren't old enough to know their multiplication tables, but they knew that a team didn't mean anything if you couldn't depend on each other. That's both a big and a small thing, knowing that there are people who will never abandon you. Kevin and Benji are alone when they enter the school, but exert a magnetic pull as they move along the corridor. Bobo and the other juniors flock around them instantly, and within 10 paces they have become a group of 12 people. Kevin and Benji don't think it odd, the way you don't if something's been going on your whole life. It's impossible to say what it is that catches Kevin's attention, because the day before a game, there's usually nothing on the planet that can distract him. But as he passes a row of lockers, his eyes meet hers. He stumbles into Benji. Benji swears at him. Kevin doesn't hear. Maya has just put her bag in her locker. And when she turns around and Kevin's eyes meet hers, she closes the locker door so quickly she nips her hand. It's over in a moment. The corridor fills with bodies and Kevin disappears in the crowd. But the friends you have when you're 15 years old obviously aren't going to miss a thing like that. "So, are you interested in hockey all of a sudden now?" Anna teases. Embarrassed, Maya rubs her hand. "Shut up, what the..." Then her face breaks into a brief smile. "Just because you don't like peanut butter doesn't necessarily mean you can't like peanuts." Anna laughs so hard she ends up spraying the inside of her locker with smoothie. "Okay, fine. But if you do talk to Kevin, the least you can do is introduce me to Benji, yeah? He's, I could eat him all up. Like, butter." Maya's brow furrows with disgust. Then she pulls the key from her locker and starts to walk off. Anna watches her and throws her arms out. "What, so you're allowed to say things like that, but not me?" "You know he doesn't come up with those jokes himself, don't you? He's not smart enough. He nicks them from the internet," Zacharias mutters, humiliated as he shakes the snow from his clothes. Letha picks up his cap and brushes the snow off it. Ahmet holds his hand out in an attempt to calm his friend down. I know you hate Bobo, but next year we'll be juniors. It'll be better then. Zacharias doesn't reply. Letha flashes him a look somewhere between anger and resignation. Letha stopped playing hockey when they were younger. He kept being told he had to be able to handle the banter in the locker room, which turned out to be a very useful argument because when Letha gave up, everyone could blame that. It was his problem, not hockey's. If Zacharias's parents hadn't loved the game as much as they did, he wouldn't have carried on playing either. And if Ahmet hadn't been so good, even he might not have been able to summon up the enthusiasm to keep playing. It'll be better when we're juniors, Ahmet repeats. Zacharias says nothing. He knows very well that he won't get a place on the junior team, and that this is his last year playing hockey. Ahmet is the only person who hasn't yet realized that he's about to leave his best friend behind. The silence doesn't bother Ahmet, who opens the door and turns a corner in the corridor, after which he can only hear a muffled rumble in his ears. She gives him tunnel vision. Hi, Maya, he exclaims, a little too loudly. She turns around fleetingly, notes his presence, but nothing more than that. When you're 15 years old, no look can hurt you more. Hi, Ahmet, she replies distractedly, and is gone before she even gets to the end of his name. Ahmet stands there, trying not to look at Zacharias and Letha, knowing they won't be making much effort not to laugh. Hi, Maya, Zacharias mimics as Letha giggles. Fuck off, Zach, Ahmet mutters. Sorry, but you've been doing this since primary school, and I was nice to you for the first 8 years you were in love with her, so now I think I've earned the right to make fun of you. Ahmet walks toward his locker, his heart sinking in his chest like a lead weight. He loves that girl more than he loves skating. Chapter 8. It's only a game. It only resolves tiny, insignificant things. Such as who gets validation, who gets listened to. It allocates power and draws boundaries and turns some people into stars and others into spectators. That's all. David enters the rink and goes straight to his office, the smallest one at the end of the corridor. He closes the door, switches his computer on, and studies videos of tomorrow's opponents. They're a brilliant team, an imposing machine, and player for player, only Kevin really matches up against them. It's going to take an immense effort for the team to stand any chance at all. But David knows that they do at least have a chance, and that every single one of his players will work themselves to death out there on the ice if need be. That isn't what's making him feel sick. It's what he's missing from the team. Speed. For several years, the junior team's first line has consisted of Kevin, Benji, and a third player called William Litt. Kevin is a genius, and Benji a fighter. But William is slow. He's big and strong, and not bad at passing. So David has managed to find tactical solutions to hide his shortcomings when they've been playing less impressive teams. But the team they're about to face is good enough to shut Kevin down unless there's someone else who's quick enough to create space for him. David rubs his temples, looks at his reflection in the computer screen, his red hair and exhausted eyes. He gets up and goes out to the bathroom, and throws up again. In a larger office, two doors away, Soon is sitting at his computer. He's watching the same clips as David, over and over again. Once upon a time, the two men always looked at events out on the ice the same way, thought the same about everything. But as the years passed, David grew older and more ambitious, while Soon became old and stubborn. When David claims that fights ought to be permitted out on the ice because there'd be fewer injuries if the guys knew they'd get beaten up for bad play, Soon retorts, "That's like saying there'd be fewer road accidents if you banned car insurance because people would take better care of their cars." When David wants to increase the load on the juniors, Soon talks about quality over quantity. If David says up, Soon yells down. When some of the other sporting associations recently proposed that Little League games should no longer keep a tally of goals and points and not have league tables until the age of 12, Soon thought it sounded sensible, while David denounced it as communism. David thinks Soon should let him do his job. Soon thinks David has misunderstood what his job actually is. The two men are stuck in their own trenches, buried too deep even to see each other anymore. Soon leans back, rubs his eyes, and hears his chair creak under his weight as he lets out a sigh. He feels like explaining to David just how lonely the job of A-team coach can be, how numbingly heavy the responsibility gets. How you need to be ready to see the bigger picture, adapt, change. But David's young, not ready to listen and understand. Soon closes his eyes and swears at himself, because isn't he just the same? One of the hardest things about getting old is admitting mistakes that it's too late to put right. The worst thing about having power over other people's lives is that you sometimes get things wrong. Soon has always refused to move young players to older age groups. The old man believes in the principle that players should develop alongside their peers, that being given opportunities too early stifles talent. But as he sits alone in his office watching these videos, he has to admit that he sees the same thing as David right now, something that hardly anyone else understands. Without a bit of pace, the junior team is going to die a death tomorrow. So even Soon finds himself wondering, what are principles worth if you don't win? Bear Town is just small enough for everyone to recognize almost everyone else, but just big enough to be full of people that no one really notices. Robbie Holtz is a few years past 40. His beard has started to turn gray. He scratches it and pulls the collar of his old camouflage jacket tighter around his neck. When the wind blows off the lake at this time of year, it feels like your face is being torn by ghosts. He's walking along the other side of the street, pretending to have important things to do, convincing himself that no one who sees him will realize that he's waiting for the pub, the Bearskin, to open. He can see the roof of the rink from here. Like everyone else, the junior team's game tomorrow is all he's talked about every waking hour since they won the quarterfinal. It's just that he no longer has many people to talk to anymore. Not since the factory got rid of him, along with 9 other guys. There's a good chance no one was interested in what he was saying before either, but that's only dawned on him recently. He looks at the time. Another hour before the Bearskin opens. He pretends it's no big deal. Keeps his hands in his pockets when he goes into the supermarket so no one will see them shaking. He fills his basket with things he doesn't need and can't afford, and puts the low-strength beer, the only sort the supermarket is allowed to sell, in last to make it look like an impulse buy. This? Oh, it might be useful to have a few beers at home, just in case. He asks if he can use the bathroom in the little hardware store. Downs the beers. Goes out and chats to the sales assistant and buys a few very specific screws that he makes very clear he needs for an item of furniture that doesn't exist. He goes back out onto the street, sees the roof of the rink again. Once upon a time, he, Robbie Holtz, was king there. Once upon a time, he showed more promise than Kevin Erdahl does now. Once upon a time, he was better than Peter Anderson. Peter turns the car around in the parking lot, pulls out onto the road, drums his fingers on the wheel. Now that the children have gone, he becomes aware of his pulse again. It's only a junior team game. Only a game. A game. He keeps repeating the mantra, but his nerves are eating him up. His lungs seem to be drawing in oxygen through his eye sockets. Hockey is a simple sport. When your desire to win is stronger than your fear of losing, you have a chance. No one wins when they're frightened. He hopes the juniors are too young to feel fear tomorrow, too naive to understand how much is at stake. Because a hockey crowd knows no nuances, only heaven or hell. Seen from the stands, you're either a genius or utterly worthless, never anything in between. An offside is never a matter for doubt. Every check is either perfectly clean or deserves a lifetime ban. When Peter was 20 and team captain and arrived back in Beartown after almost winning the final of the top league in the country, he was met by his dad's voice from the kitchen. Almost? For Christ's sake, you can't almost get on a boat. You're either on the boat or in the water. And when all the other buggers are in the water as well, no one gives a shit that you were the last one to end up there. When Peter got his contract with the NHL and was about to move to Canada, his dad told him in no uncertain terms not to think he was anything special. It's possible that the old man meant it more gently than it came out. That he intended to say that humility and hard work would take the boy just as far over there as they had here. It's possible that drink made his words sharper. It's possible that Peter didn't mean to slam the door quite as hard as he did. It doesn't matter now. A young man left Beartown in silence, and when he came home again, it was too late for words. You can't look a gravestone in the eye and ask its forgiveness. Peter remembers walking alone down all the small streets where he grew up and realizing that people he had known his whole life looked at him differently now. He remembers how they would suddenly stop talking when he walked in the room. He was relieved when that passed, when they stopped seeing him as a star and started to see him as general manager. Then, as the club went on tumbling down through the divisions and people told the GM what they really thought, he discovered that that part of him wished they still saw him as a star. Because a hockey crowd knows no nuances, only heaven or hell. So why does he carry on? Because he's never considered any alternatives. It's hard for a lot of people to remember the reasons why they started to love the thing they love. But it's easy for Peter. The greatest reason for his love of hockey, from the very first moment he stood on a pair of skates, was the silence. Everything outside the rink, the cold and the darkness, and the fact that his mom was ill and his dad would be drunk again when he got home, it all went quiet inside his head when he stepped onto the ice. He was 4 years old that first time, but hockey told him straight away that it was going to demand complete devotion from him. He loved it for that, and still does. A man who is the same age as Peter, but looks 15 years older, sees Peter's car pass through the town. He pulls his camouflage jacket more tightly around him and scratches his beard. When they were 17 years old, there was only one person in the whole of Beartown who thought Peter was more talented than Robbie when it came to hockey. Talent is like letting two balloons up into the air. The most interesting thing isn't watching which one climbs fastest, but which one has the longest string, that old bastard Soon used to say. He was right, of course. The board and the sponsors forced him to move Robbie up to the A-team, even though the coach insisted that the boy wasn't ready mentally. Robbie kept getting hammered with hard checks, got injured, got scared, and spent the rest of the season hitting the puck into the boards rather than risk a fight. The first time the crowd booed him, he went home and cried. The second time, he went home and got drunk. When he turned 18, he was worse than he had been when he was 17. While Peter was better than anything this town had ever seen. When Peter was offered the chance to move to the A-team, he was ready. Robbie started to doubt himself every time he stepped out onto the ice, while nothing scared Peter. He went off to the NHL the same year Robbie started work at the factory. There are no almosts in hockey. One player achieved his dreams, while the other now finds himself stamping his feet in the snow until the pub door finally opens. A short flight of stairs leads down to the bar, 5 steps. From down there, you can't see the roof of the rink. Soon hears David leave his office. He waits until the bathroom door opens and closes. Then the old man writes 4 words on a yellow post-it note and stands up. He goes into David's office and sticks it onto the screen of his computer. Soon isn't a religious man, but at that moment he prays to all the powers he can think of that he's not making a mistake. That those 4 words aren't going to wreck another young boy's life. For a moment, he thinks about waiting until David comes back, then looking him in the eye and telling him the truth as he sees it. "I hope you never stop arguing, David. I hope you never stop telling us to go to hell. That's how you've made it to the top." But he goes back to his own office instead and closes the door. Sports creates complicated men, proud enough to refuse to admit their mistakes, but humble enough always to put their team first. When David gets back from the washroom, he reads the 4 words on a post-it note stuck to his computer monitor. Amit. Boys team. Fast. It's only a game. It can only change people's lives. Chapter 9. All adults have days when we feel completely drained. When we no longer know quite what we spend so much time fighting for. When reality and everyday worries overwhelm us and we wonder how much longer we're going to be able to carry on. The wonderful thing is that we can all live through far more days like that without breaking than we think. The terrible thing is that we never know exactly how many. When the members of her family are asleep, Kira still goes around the house and counts them. Her own mother always did that with her children, Kira and her 5 siblings, counting them every night. Her mother said she didn't understand how anyone could have children and not do that, how anyone could live without being terrified of losing them at any moment. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Kira would hear her whisper through the house, and each child would lie there with his or her eyes closed and feel that they had been seen and acknowledged. It's one of her most treasured childhood memories. Kira is driving from Little Bear Town to the larger town beyond the forest. Her commute to work takes longer than most people could bear, but it feels surprisingly quick to Kira, since she has the sense of having crossed the entire universe when she gets out of the car. Even though the larger town is many times smaller than the city where she was born, it's a different world from the one among the trees. A larger world with colleagues to be spurred on by, friends to discuss culture and politics with, opponents to analyze and fight against. She's often told that it's odd that a woman who doesn't understand hockey ended up marrying a hockey player, but that's not entirely fair. She finds the game perfectly logical. It's just the intensity of the training she doesn't understand. The adrenaline, the hunger, teetering on the brink of fear, throwing yourself off the edge of the abyss and either floating or being swallowed up. Kira understands all that. She experiences it in the courtroom, in negotiations. Law is a different sort of game with a different set of rules. But you're either a competitive person or you aren't. Like they say in Beartown, some people have the bear in them. Perhaps that's why Kira, who up to the age of 19 had never lived anywhere with fewer than 1 million inhabitants, has been able to make a home for herself among the forest dwellers in spite of everything. She understands their love of the fight. She shares it. She knows that one of the funny things about fighting for success, and God knows Kira fought her way through her legal training alongside kids from rich families who never had to do the washing up in the family restaurant in the evenings, is that you never really stop fighting. You never stop being scared of falling from the top, because when you close your eyes, you can still feel the pain from each and every step of the way up. Peter already has a pain in his stomach when he steps into the president's office. It's messy, littered with old photographs and cups. There are some expensive bottles of drink on a table in one corner, golf clubs, and a half-open wardrobe containing a spare suit and clean shirts. They're going to be needed. The president is sitting at his desk eating a sandwich the way a German shepherd would try to eat a balloon filled with mayonnaise. Peter tries to stop himself from wiping down both the desk and the president with napkins, and at least manages to stop before he gets to the president. "Can you close the door?" the president mutters as he chews. Peter takes a deep breath and feels his guts tie themselves in knots. He knows that everyone in the town thinks he's naive, that he doesn't understand where this is going, but he's really just good at hoping. He closes the door and gives up on that. "We're going to appoint David as coach of the A-team," the president says, like a training video on how not to be diplomatic. Peter nods bitterly. The president brushes some crumbs from his tie. "Everyone knows how close you and Soon are," he adds by way of an apology. Peter doesn't respond. The president wipes his fingers on his pants. "Don't look like that, for God's sake, as if I just stole the presents from under your Christmas tree. We need to put the good of the club first, Peter." Peter looks down at the floor. He's a team player. That's how he would describe himself. And the starting point for that is always understanding your own role and its limitations. He's going to have to tell himself that plenty of times today, force his brain to control his heart. It was Soon who persuaded him to become GM, and it was Soon's door that was always open to him when things got tough. "With all due respect, you know I don't agree about that. I don't think David's ready," he said quietly. He doesn't make eye contact with the president and looks around the walls of the office instead, as if he were looking for something. The only time he avoids eye contact is when something feels extremely unpleasant. Kira says he starts shooting imaginary clay pigeons as soon as he finds himself in any sort of conflict. He can't even point out that he's been given the wrong change in the supermarket without breaking into a cold sweat and wanting to curl up into a ball. The wall behind the president is decorated with pictures and pennants, and one of them, ancient and faded, reads culture, values, community. Peter feels like asking the president what he thinks that means.